Now listen to the language that they use. They do this very deliberately. An airliner traveling at hundreds of miles per hour, we're going to talk about that, carrying some 10,000 gallons of jet fuel, plowed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. At 9:03, a second airliner hit the South Tower. Fire and smoke billowed upward. Steel, glass, ash, and bodies fell below. The Twin Towers, where up to 50,000 people work each day, both collapsed less than 90 minutes later, aside at free fall speed. We'll talk about that. At 9:37 the same morning, a third airliner slammed into the western face of the Pentagon. At 10:03, a fourth airliner crashed in a field in southern Pennsylvania. It, we were told, had been aimed at the United States Capitol or White House and was forced down by heroic passengers armed with the knowledge that America may be under attack. Yeah. We're going to talk about that nonsense as well, my friends. Welcome to Far Out with Faust, everybody. I am Faust Chicho, and today I'm excited to be bringing to you guys my long-anticipated, much-promised solo podcast on 9/11. The events that went into that. And as I have mentioned in my broadcasts and previous teasers, the word impossible comes to mind. And I'm going to put that in the title somewhere because I'm going to be presenting to you guys a compilation of everything that we've been told about that day. And in part one, we're going to focus on just the impossible, the impossibility of everything that we were sold. And then part two, we're going to circle around to the powers that be, the motivation and incentive they had, and some of the people who, in all probability, had a direct hand in the orchestration and execution of the events of that day and everything that led up to it, and particularly everything that followed. So, where to begin, my friends? This is going to be fun. Buckle up. So, we must begin, as absurd as it is, we must begin with the official narrative, right? What we've been told. Just to review now, okay? Before we dive in, let's review, shall we? The conclusion of the 9/11 Commission, as you guys, if you subscribe to me and follow me, then you already know commissions is where the truth goes to die. Okay? And the 9/11 Commission was absolutely no exception. The 9/11 Commission, we were told, and this was driven into our heads endlessly, incessantly, traumatically, over and over and over, with media coverage of those planes crashing and buildings on fire. They did this, they do this on purpose. You guys know that. You guys who follow me know their tactics. And it was gruesome, and they showed it to us again and again. But here, let me just, it was 8:46 in the morning, September 11th, 2001, and the United States had become a nation transformed. Now listen to the language that they use. They do this very deliberately. An airliner traveling at hundreds of miles per hour, we're going to talk about that, carrying some 10,000 gallons of jet fuel, plowed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. At 9:03, a second airliner hit the South Tower. Fire and smoke billowed upward. Steel, glass, ash, and bodies fell below. The Twin Towers, where up to 50,000 people work each day, both collapsed less than 90 minutes later, aside at free fall speed. We'll talk about that. At 9:37 the same morning, a third airliner slammed into the western face of the Pentagon. At 10:03, a fourth airliner crashed in a field in southern Pennsylvania. It, we were told, had been aimed at the United States Capitol or White House and was forced down by heroic passengers armed with the knowledge that America may be under attack. Yeah. We're going to talk about that nonsense as well, my friends. More than 2,600 people died at the World Trade Center. 125 died at the Pentagon. 256 died on four planes. The death toll surpassed that of Pearl Harbor in 1941. Now, let's talk about the psychological warfare of this from the beginning, okay? We were told this was the transformation of America, and it was. And we're going to talk about how, and it was not certainly for the better, not for us. Let me remind you what the warmongering neocons and neolibs at Project for a New American Century had written in a report in the year 2000, almost 1 year to the September 11th attack dates. What was needed for America to dominate much of humanity and the world's resources, it said, was, quote, some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, okay? And that's exactly what they went about making sure happened. So, you know, we can get into, and you've heard, if you subscribe to me, you know that the notion that there are surprise terror attacks on Western society of any multitude is fantasy. In fact, fantasy has much more of a possibility of being real. Like if you believe in the Tooth Fairy, there's much greater probability that the Tooth Fairy is real than the United States was surprise attacked on September 11th, or Israel on October 7th, for that matter. If you understand the technology that we have, the espionage capability that we have had for decades, if you understand that there is not a single conversation taking place on the planet that they can't listen in on, that they have every ability to and have had this for some time, they could photograph and count the hairs on your head from space. Walls are no prevention. They know who's who and where's what. They can listen in on conversations happening inside buildings, even underground. They have done this. The technology has long existed. So get with the times, my friends. You have to understand the rules of the game if you're going to be able to see what's happening in reality. None of us really, I mean, I was more of in a much more delinquent phase when this happened. But even I was like, what the? But anyway, now we need to know better because they're still doing it, okay? They're still doing these. They're still pulling these false flags. And the people, don't be confused about what a false flag is. America knew full well what was happening, okay? And if you doubt that, let me just share just a little tiny clip with you just to get the ball rolling, okay?
It was not specific as to time, nor place, nor manner of attack.
No specific
bullshit.
Threat involving domestic operation or involving what happened, obviously. The city's
lies.
Airliner
bold-faced
and so forth.
There were no warning signs that I'm aware of that would indicate this type of operation in the country.
All these statements are false. A joint congressional inquiry on September 11 has revealed that in spring and summer of 2001, there had been a flood of warnings about possible terrorist attacks in the United States, some using airplanes as weapons.
Duh.
In fact, as reported by the New York Times, American aviation officials were warned as early as 1998 that Al-Qaeda could seek to hijack a commercial jet and slam it into a U.S. landmark.
No shit.
The London Times has revealed that the British MI6 warned the American intelligence services about a plot to hijack aircraft and crash them into buildings 2 years before the September 11 attacks.
Only 2 years to prepare?
Russian President Vladimir Putin has said publicly that he ordered his intelligence agencies to alert the United States last summer in 2001 that suicide pilots were training for attacks on U.S. targets. German intelligence alerted the CIA in June 2001 that Middle Eastern terrorists were training for hijackings.
Are you getting the point?
The Sunday Herald has confirmed that Britain gave President Bush
understand?
A categorical warning to expect multiple airline hijackings 1 month before the September 11 attacks.
There is no
Then there was
surprise
the infamous
attack.
August 6th memo.
President Bush was told in August that Osama bin Laden might be planning an attack involving the hijacking of U.S. aircraft.
It's titled Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. The two-page memo
I
states,
bet you Bush was very surprised.
FBI information indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this
really?
Country.
consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks. Maybe it's no coincidence that the FBI advised their own boss to stop flying commercial airliners as early as 6 weeks
before 9/11.
Hey, boss,
maybe you better...
Why is the Attorney General of the United States doing all his air travel by specially chartered jet?
The Justice Department cited what it called a threat assessment by the FBI and said Ashcroft has been advised of his term.
Knowing that the attacks were imminent, knowing that they might involve hijacked airliners, but not knowing where and when they could happen, would have been...
Anyway, that's just, we're just getting the ball rolling here, my friends, okay? Just so you know, dozens of countries warned us years in advance, leading up to months in advance, weeks in advance. Guess what? The U.S. wasn't taking any calls. You know why? Because we were, I mean Bush and Cheney and the same criminals operating these days, the shadow government, they were the ones doing all the orchestrating. Every intelligence agency catches wind, but they don't. You understand that there's plausible deniability used at every step of the way, right? So they don't know, but they're going to tell people just in case it's real. But, you know, I'm sure some of them figured out that the U.S. wasn't interested in knowing. They know our tendencies. We weren't interested in knowing about Pearl Harbor, were we? No, we pretended like we never got that call. Same with the Lusitania. Anyway, let's get into this, guys. Let's start at the beginning, okay? Now that we know that the notion of a surprise attack is laughable, all right? This talking about the most sophisticated agencies on the planet here, people, okay? It's just... Let's get into the impossibilities, the nonsense, okay? Now, there are... I was debating about how... I put this off so long, guys, because there is so much information. I mean, it seems impossible that there could be this much belligerent, like, just complete, unbelievable aspects of this that make the whole thing seem like they couldn't have really convinced people that this happened the way it did, could they? But there are, and in an attempt to compile them, you know, where to focus on is a very big challenge, and anybody who has done this research can tell you where to begin. It's a mountain of shit. It is a mountain of bullshit is what it is. You know, there was the NORAD exercises. Just coincidentally, on the morning of 9/11, they were another mind-blowing coincidence, you know. NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, was conducting military exercises all over the northeastern United States that day. How fucking convenient. What does that mean? There was war games happening, okay? Simulations of hijackings. Simulations, practice hijackings. Okay, you know, when they do that, they act like there's a real one. Oh, guess what that does? That really throws a monkey wrench if there's a real one, doesn't it? How convenient. Did the hijackers know that? The hijackers. We're going to talk about them. You can imagine that there was a complete clusterfuck of disarray when calls started to go out in the morning in the midst of this entire coastal exercise, that there were real hijackings happening. Did they call off the exercises? No. They didn't call off the exercises. Of course not. That would have lessened the confusion and actually enabled America's protocol response to hijackings, which is to get our incredible, you know, Air Force F-16, what, you know, state-of-the-art technology deployed in a heartbeat on those hijacked planes. That is the protocol, guys. But they couldn't do that. You know why? The whole fleet just was inconveniently out of place, out of gas, and out of time. And they made sure of that. I promise you, every step of the way. I could spend 3 hours talking just about that. So there was the NORAD circle jerk happening. the NORAD exercise is happening. How very, very convenient. We didn't shut down. All you need to know is the exercises were never canceled. They were never shut down. The hijackings happened. There were calls went out. They didn't call off the exercises. Of course they didn't. Just as George Bush didn't leave the room talking with the kids, because they knew there was no emergency for them, okay? And they weren't going to call off the exercise because that would have lended a little bit of organized response to what they needed to be a complete fucking debacle. Obviously, all of this frustrates me. So, you know, there's a lot to get into. Let's move on. I want to get into some... I'm going through some of these things that you need to remember, but I'm getting it to... the impossible. I'm getting to the biggest things that you can hang your hat on so that you know that every fucking thing that you've been told about that day is complete and utter bullshit. It is impossible in so many ways. And I'm taking today, I'm going to lay out what I feel is the most, strongest way to show you just exactly what I mean by when I say impossible. Okay. Obviously Rumsfeld and Cheney, you know, those two guys, those two career criminals, fucking dirty rats. You know what they did, how they got so close with Bush. Their job in the CIA and in Washington was making sure that none of the CIA's misdeeds and atrocities leaked out into the public sphere. That's what those guys ran damage control for a long time. That was their job. How do you think they got to the highest office in the United States? That's how you get to the highest office in the United States. Okay? Particularly if you're working for a Bush or a Clinton. Anyway, let's talk about this. It just so happens, and everybody knows this, most people, God willing, know this. What was the genius leadership doing on leading up into September 10th? We had a press conference. Remember that press conference? Rumsfeld, washing his hands and saying, I have just trillions of dollars have disappeared. Oh, why wasn't the head of our national defense taking command from the start of this? Well, maybe he was looking for the couple trillion dollars that the Pentagon decided they were going to announce to everyone that they misplaced. Anyway, over at the White House, an even stranger situation was brewing as the Transportation Secretary Norma Mineta testified. I'm going to show you that in part two. Some of you already know that little bit that I'm talking about. Let's talk about... So we have to get into the physics of this, okay, guys? Because this is fucking ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. Okay, let's start with should we start with the planes or the hijackers? I guess it doesn't matter. Both things are impossible. Let's start with the hijackers. Where's Waldo? Let's start with the hijackers, okay? Now, besides the fact that it has come out that the alleged hijackers, I say alleged because, well, you'll see, that there was, almost every single one of them had direct ties to the United States government. And approximately five of the 19 alleged hijackers were on each of the flights, right? Doing the math, four flights, 19. So their names should have been on the passenger list. Yet, as far as I understand it, that's suspicious. Okay. So let's run the gamut of actual evidence versus superficial evidence plans. Okay. Because like everything the government gets their hands in when they're false flagging an event, you have what you would call an orgy of evidence. Well, what some people might call that, but it's, you know, basically I'm talking about like evidence for fucking dummies, evidence for morons, like, you know, when you're trying to pull off a caper or, you know, a devastating, catastrophic, world-changing event like 9/11, you tend to be in a mild state of fight or flight. And so not a lot of thought goes into knowing that you own the media. You don't need to be sophisticated about the evidence that you plant. You just need to be fucking on the nose with it. Like, for example, Muhammad Atta's passport surviving the plane crash when even the towers didn't survive the plane crash. But his passport did. In Kryptonian fashion, it flew from the plane and landed on the rubble. Fucking amazing. Incredible feat for a passport to do that. My God. It must have been created in, you know, on Krypton. It must be where Superman's from. Anyway, let's talk about these fucking absurd evidence plants, okay? So let me check something here. Okay, good. I want to make sure I'm not sharing my screen when I should be talking to you. Okay. So we have the passport. Everybody knows the passport. I mean, there's a perfect example. I mean, it's like the bullet, Kennedy's magic bullet they found on Governor Connolly's fucking stretcher. This is the same people, same tactics, same absurdities, same nonsense, same impossibilities. Okay. I mean, for 6 months, they claimed that this passport was proof of the narrative that the hijackers were Arab, and they were peddling that, and they were running with that. And then a funny thing happened on the way to the New World Order. The guy whose passport they found on top of the rubble turned up alive and well, as reported by the BBC News on Sunday, September 23rd, 2001. Oops. God, I hate when that happens. God, you know, some of these guys might be hard to find, you know, living in that part of the world. The United States says, yeah, this guy will do. No one's heard from him in a couple of years. Turns out he has a phone and everything, you know. That phone call must have been fun for CNN. Hello, who is this again? hang up. Anyway, now, some other absurdities, all right? We were told that both black box... Wait, we'll get into the black boxes, okay? Black boxes, indestructible cases, okay? Incredible little feats of engineering they are. Remarkable things. Very, very... how about this? They've never been known to incinerate. Not ever. They've disappeared at the bottom of the ocean. But they've never simply evaporated. Okay. So let's continue on with the hijackers and this and these evidence, this fucking nonsense. So, like I said, they do this for the media. They know it's confusion. It sows confusion. It backs their narrative. They know that the media is going to run with it and ponder on it and pontificate about it and talk. Everyone's going to come up with their own opinion and theories. And they want people because that furthers their narrative, you know. So Muhammad Atta was clearly chosen to use more than one intelligence-insulting evidence plant, okay, because it was his suitcase, by sheer coincidence, that was never loaded onto the hijacked plane. And it also conveniently fell right into the hands of investigators. I guess he forgot it. Yeah. It was conveniently filled to the brim with incriminating evidence, including a, so cliche, copy of the Quran, a video titled How to Fly a Commercial Plane. Oh my God. I would have loved to press play and see what the fuck was on that video. And a fuel consumption indicator. Do you understand? They put a fuel consumption indicator in his fucking briefcase and then tried to tell you that he did that. That's like, you know, a nozzle, like a physical. This is just fuck. I mean, it's beyond insulting. Okay. Why would he pack that with a video and a Quran? Okay. Obviously he wasn't planning on reading it again or watching the video. Okay. Anyway, 2001, you got to understand that this is a hardware gauge. It's a fuel gauge. I mean, but if you're planning evidence, for stupid people. I guess it works out just fine. So he was very, Mr. Otto was very, very forgetful in general, because he also left a few more surprises for the investigators to find and scoop right up. Reportedly, he forgot one of his other copies of his Quran at a Florida strip club in another rental car that he had. Damn it. You know, you leave in a strip club, shit's getting hot, you have a few martinis or whatever Muhammad Adam might drink, you forget your Quran in a car that you rented in Florida. Yeah, you know, it happens. It happens. So, also, you should know, there was the ever-incriminating flight manuals that were recovered in Arabic, found just at random in several parked rental cars at the airports. Those pesky terrorists. How? What would just, I mean, maybe just to haunt us, you know? Let's just pick a few random cars and throw some Arabic flight manuals into them, just so people know who is responsible. I mean, this is fucking ludicrous, okay? Why would terrorists, why wouldn't they just take a taxi? Why would they rent 55 cars leaving Qurans and flight manuals in them? You have to be fucking stupid to believe any of this for even a moment, okay? And of course, the news was more than happy to report on it and feed the stupidity to the masses who were traumatized, in our defense, looking at fucking videos of planes crashing into buildings nonstop for days and weeks and months on end. And if you lived in New York City, like I did at the time, that wasn't even half of it. Oh, I thought it was apropos to also mention, you know, as things start to die down and you're trying to, you know, go to war on an entire nation and region of the planet in order to rape and pillage its resources, then you have to keep people distracted, especially when they're starting to say, wait a minute, what did they say happened on that day? How come there was no plane parts? Do something. Yeah, okay. I know. Let's fill up envelopes with anthrax and send them to people and we'll sign them in Arabic. Brilliant. 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 Yeah. So, you know, keep the terror going. If people are scared, they're not thinking. Okay? That's a fact. That's a biological fact. If you're scared, you can't really think. All the blood is receded from your frontal lobe and is making its way to your extremities in case you have to punch or run. That's just the way biology is, my friends, and they know that very well. So what did they do? They set up an entire debacle using anthrax in envelopes and mailing them around. And it came out later, you probably don't know this because it's not like the news reported on it, but it did come out later that that anthrax was created in a U.S. Army lab and was never mailed by a Muslim terrorist, okay? While I'm not denying that Muslim terrorists exist on the planet, I can tell you that they are absolutely, unequivocally, the creation and byproduct of Western imperialism and colonialism and whatever the fuck else you want to call it. Methodically, this goes back to the Tavistock Institute and the turn of the century in Britain. Not this century, the last. You think all the brotherhoods and organizations in the Middle East were started by accident? No. No. They are the children of these think tanks who knew they needed to create opposition and stir up shit in those areas that they were colonizing. Fact. This, the brainchild of these people. Anyway, that's another, we'll do a different special on that. So I just thought I would mention the anthrax since, you know, that was the whole, that went around as well. So at least six of the men named by the FBI are allegedly still alive today. How do you hijack and kamikaze a plane and end up alive and well in Pakistan or in one of the other countries? That's fascinating. Has the FBI revised their list based on some of these recent findings? I mean, they're not that recent, don't get me wrong. Of course not. No, they're not going to revise their list. They're not going to change their Wikipedia page on what happened. No, they don't want you to know what happened. Okay? I'm sure you'll see a nice footnote at the bottom of this video explaining to you what happened, just in case you're questioning events. So, these so-called hijackers. Now, this is incredible, because the fact remains that in 10 years, we've never seen a single image proving that the 19 alleged terrorists boarded the hijacked airplanes. Not one. Now, to address this belligerently inconvenient fact, the 9/11 Commission wrote that, quote, the security checkpoint in Newark, like the checkpoints in Boston, lacked closed circuit television surveillance. That's a bold-faced lie in the 9/11 Commission report, which is filled with bold-faced lies. That's what the report is comprised of, okay? In a Los Angeles Times article dated September 13th, 2001, former FBI Assistant Director Louis Chalero is quoted saying that, quote, FBI agents examined footage from dozens of cameras at three airports where the terrorists boarded the aircraft. That's what he said. That's the direct quote. There's also a lengthy account by David Brent, a tactical information engineer who worked for the company that installed the cameras, security cameras at Dulles. After the 9/11 attacks, he stated, and I quote, I was part of a team that had the laborious task of reviewing all of the video from the airport. That's every frame from over 300 cameras with 30 days of retention time. The task took 3 weeks of 15-hour days. All that and nothing? Wow. Not a fucking trace. Ghostly. Very ghostly of these hijackers to somehow avoid all surveillance in every fucking airport. That's incredible. Were they X-Men? Like, did they have mutant abilities? Were they vampires? No, vampires don't show up in a mirror. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, because it's not fucking true that they were the hijackers. I mean, not that you understand what I'm saying. So it begs the question, where are the images of the terrorists? Okay, even if the checkpoints from two or three of the airports didn't have functional cameras, we should have dozens and dozens and dozens of images of the 19 alleged terrorists standing in line for check-in, walking to the airport. Maybe one of them was a little nervous, needed a bottle of water. Maybe he went to the store. They had to get their boarding passes, right? They had to walk through space, through the airport with their bodies to hijack the planes. Am I right? Is that accurate to say, right? Maybe they were sweating a little. Maybe they're having second thoughts about life. I don't know. We'll never know, because there's no evidence whatsoever of them in any of the airports. Okay? All of these premises, all of these airports, every part of them had cameras, my friends. Everywhere. That's what airports do. All right? The cameras are used to keep an eye on customers. It's part of the overall security. It's all coordinated. It always has been. This is not fucking new technology. Okay? We would and we should have seen the terrorists sitting in the departure lounges, waiting for the boarding call, you know, finally proceeding through the gates that would take them into the airplanes. But we never did, and we never will. Why? Why were we never shown a single image of the 19 alleged hijackers moving through different areas of the airports on the morning of 9/11? Washington Dulles did have security cameras at the checkpoints. Why weren't we shown the properly time-stamped images of the five terrorists? Okay, because the video that they put out, CIA production, just conveniently doesn't have a timestamp on it. Okay, every security camera in an airport has a timestamp on it. If a video shows up after the fact with no timestamp, you can rest assured it's a Fugazi, okay? That's not how timestamps and security cameras at airports work. You can't separate one from the other. There's a reason for that, okay? But the video that they released later on, the one that you might be thinking of, well, wait a minute, wasn't there that video, that one? Yeah, there was a video of, we were told, two of the hijackers at an airport. We have no idea of knowing which airport, and there was no timestamp or date. And to top it all off, it's a different kind of camera. it was a motion camera, like a camcorder. It was not shot with the same kind of frame per second as security cameras had in 2001. That's another little blip. I mean, I could spend an hour talking about just about that. So we have serious, serious inconsistencies. We lack substantial evidence any of these hijackers were even in the airport, let alone got on a fucking plane. Okay? So, 19 patsies? Perhaps. I mean, the conclusion and opinion I've come to, my conclusions will always change as I review more evidence. And it has changed dramatically even since I've been doing this last deep dive on this, is that not these hijackers were patsies, that they never actually went to the airport and boarded these planes. Okay. I have personal opinions about how this was pulled off, and it has nothing to do with Arab or Muslim or Islamic hijackers. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to the next completely fucking impossible feat of the day. Now, the planes. The planes. What about the planes? So a lot of people don't believe there were planes. Okay? There was something. There was something. I'm not one to believe that the planes were interspliced in after the fact. Okay, there's a lot of video, and not all of it from, you know, media, of planes crashing into the fucking... They needed the planes. It was all part of the plan. Anyway, listen. The planes, guys. The planes. Do you guys understand that there was a plan way back in 1962 called Operation Northwoods, okay? It was proposed to John F. Kennedy by the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States of America, among many other sick and twisted false flag scenarios, in order to justify an invasion of Cuba. So way back in 1962, back when the government and the military industrial complex had not created a plausibly deniable state of, you know, participation for each part of the governments, they were still, you know, muddying the waters here, which is why what happened to John and Bobby afterwards happened. But this was a proposal, fact, to hijack a commercial airliner and replace it with what? With a drone. Good idea. That was an idea that they had to help justify a war in 1962. Table that. Table that. That's a good idea. There was a lot of real twisted ideas in Operation Northwoods. You know, bomb a cruise ship, hijack a... So, good plan. They found a use for it, I believe, in 2001, finally. And I'm going to show you why I believe that very, very, very firmly, and why what they say happened with these alleged hijackers, impossible, absolutely unequivocally impossible. Not just because the hijackers seem to be ghosts and don't exist, but even the stories that we were told about their ability to fly a plane would not allow them to do what these airplanes did. It's fucking impossible. Let me show you how. Okay. Let me share my screen. Okay. Let me see here. We're going to go back. The planes. minutes. Oh, my friends, this is going to be fun. So, let's see here. The planes. So, the VMO of a plane is the max operating velocity. Okay, now this is very important to understand why what happened is impossible for a commercial airliner. Now, a reinforced military drone built to look like a commercial airliner and being flown by remote, now we're talking. And I'm going to show you the behavior and the physics-defying feats of these planes, which back up that claim. But one thing is for certain, no commercial airliner piloted by, complete amateurs with no ability to even fly a commercial jet could have done what they said these planes did and what these planes were recorded to have done. So let's talk about this, okay? This is fucking mad. The VMO is the max operating velocity, okay? The rule is never. Now, I'm just trying to think if I should explain this to you or if I should show you a video, which I'll do both. So you, as a human being, you understand, you felt the difference between moving on the ground and moving underwater. Big, big difference, right? So if you were to strap a rocket to a human and send him rocketing underwater at 100 miles per hour for a couple miles, you would see that rocket, when it stopped, the human would be hardly recognizable, okay? Because the force and resistance of the water would obliterate that person strapped to the rocket. It would be a dangle of limbs if it was still connected at all. This is also the reason why, if you jump from a bridge that's too high, when you hit the water, you might as well have jumped onto concrete. That the resistance is great. And the thicker the medium, the greater the resistance. All right. So the same thing applies to airplanes, my friends, and pilots will tell you this. At 30,000 feet, the air is very thin. All right. And an airplane can easily and safely travel at speeds of upward of 500 miles per hour. That's why they gain the altitude they do and can go as fast as they do. Thin air means that there isn't much resistance to worry about. However, as soon as that plane begins to reduce its altitude, it also has to reduce its speed for the reasons I was just telling you. Okay. Atmosphere gets thicker as you get closer to sea level. This is not something that is like, okay, sometimes it is. No, this is an always thing. This is a hard, fast rule. It's an absolute. It's a necessity. You have to reduce speed as you approach sea level, or the structural integrity of the airplane will not withstand the resistance. It will, in fact, fall the fuck apart. Okay, it's called the flutter effect, and every pilot knows it, because in order to get through school, they have to learn to be sensitive to it, and you'll crash every simulation that you come in too hot. Okay, below 10,000 feet, altitude speeds are around 250 miles per hour. That is the recommendation. Now, each airplane has a specific maximum operating velocity. It's called a VMO. And the rule is never. It should never be exceeded at low altitudes. And never means never for a reason, all right? If the VMO of the plane is exceeded, it causes a flutter effect. It's called the flutter phenomenon, okay? And it causes irreversible damage to the plane. I mean, you've seen pictures of what a fucking pigeon can do to a plane when you hit it that fast. When a plane starts to fall apart in midair, you're in a lot of trouble, okay? And it can affect any plane. It's not even just, commercial jets, but so I want to cue this. This is why I am of the firm belief that these planes had to have been piloted not only by remote, but also that the commercial airlines, airliners that went up were replaced, just as Operation Northwoods intended, just as the plan, the longstanding plan to use this to start a war, you know, was written back in 1962. I believe the planes were replaced with military grade jets, reinforced. They had to have been reinforced, and I'm going to show you why.
To its target without having a pilot. Now that is a possibility as well.
One fact that seems to support this possibility are the exceptional speeds these airplanes were able to achieve at low altitudes near sea level. As we know, a person can easily run at top speed through normal air, but he cannot do the same in a much thicker medium like water. If he were to be pushed at the same speeds,
that's what I was just telling you guys,
he would probably lose his arms and legs and feet. The air is very thin, structural. The flutter phenomenon can affect any kind of airplane, from large military bombers to small ailerons at risk, but also the fuselage begins suffering from the air pressure caused by the speed. This is what happened to an Air China 747, which exceeded the maximum operating speed, or VMO, in the desperate effort to recover from an engine failure.
For the first time, Captain Ho takes manual control of the plane.
This is a dramatic.
Hold the plane and perform an emergency landing. Visible all over the plane. The maximum operating speed for a 767, two of the four hijacked airplanes, is 414 miles per hour. For the other two airplanes, the 757s, the VMO is even less, 402 miles per hour. Yet on 9/11, all four airplanes were flown at speeds close to or beyond 500 miles per hour near sea level without suffering any visible structural damage, while remaining
That's perfectly under control all the way into their targets.
Oh, shit!
American 11 hit high up in the North Tower around the 93rd floor, going a pretty astonishing rate of speed, almost 500 miles an hour.
Here comes a very large target. Descending rapidly, very fast.
Diving very steeply and very fast.
He's really moving.
He was moving fast.
United Flight 175.
They never see
that. Streaking through the skies over New York at more than 600 miles an hour. Barely missed colliding with another commercial flight.
The back of my neck stands up when we talk about the hijacking. We watched the speed. Very high rate of speed. I believe it was about 600 knots southbound, which was extremely unusual for an air carrier.
According to the NTSB, during the descent from 12,000 to 6,000 feet, the aircraft ground speed remained between 500 and 520 knots. It then impacted World Trade Center Tower 2 at approximately 510 knots ground speed. 510 knots is 586 miles per hour.
Fucking
that's almost 200
dude.
Miles per hour beyond the maximum
no
operating velocity
way.
Of a
767. So do you understand that if you go past 400, you're going to start to flutter? They went over 200 miles per hour faster than that structural integrity of that commercial airliner could take. That is impossible. It's not just a little bit. Okay, well, I want to show you one more thing now. Hold on a second. Where is it? Where did it go? Magic Airplanes. I think this is the one. Let's see. Oh, yeah.
So had flown the actual airplanes involved in
9/11. This dude flew
the two
both
actual
airplanes.
Aircraft, which were involved in 9/11, the flight number 175 and flight 93, the 757 that allegedly went down at Shanksville, and flight 175 is the aircraft that's alleged to have hit the South Tower. I don't believe it's possible for a terrorist, a so-called terrorist, to train on a 172, then jump in the cockpit of a 757, 767 glass cockpit, and vertical navigate the aircraft, lateral navigate the aircraft, and fly the airplane at speeds exceeding its design limit
Impossible.
Speed by well over 100 knots, make high speed, high bank turns, exceeding, pulling probably 5, 6, 7 Gs, and the aircraft would literally fall out of the sky. I couldn't do it, and I'm absolutely positive they couldn't do it.
How do you feel about United 175 reaching 510 knots?
Physically impossible to have a
physically
clock near 510 knots
with a commercial airliner at sea level is physically impossible.
Flight 175 that hit the second tower, they said it was going at roughly 560 miles an hour at sea.
With a commercial airliner at sea level, so, is physically listen, impossible.
For everyone listening, that's Ralph Kolstad speaking. He is a 20-year U.S. Navy Top Gun, twice Corps member, and he's speaking this evidence from the Pilots for 9/11 Truth, okay? And he's talking about how, obviously, we know what he's talking about, how impossible it is.
It's physically impossible.
Flight 175 that hit the second tower, they said it was going at roughly 560 miles an hour at sea level.
No, that's impossible. You need so much power to push yourself through that air. So the engines have the right amount of horsepower for cruising at 30,000 feet at 500 plus miles an hour. To do that at ground level, you need six times that amount of power. Those engines can't put out six times more power.
No, nope. Even the engines were incapable.
Changed up the mortars so they had were mortars that had six times the thrust. Then, you know, theoretically you could, but then the structure is not strong enough. Under all circumstances, I'd say an absolute resounding no.
To me, it's impossible. You know, any pilot that has been in a commercial jet would probably laugh at if you said 510 knots.
Is it possible to fly over 500 miles an hour at sea level?
No.
That's because Captain Gordon Wilson. He's an aeronautical engineer in Vancouver, Canada.
Greater than its maximum speed at sea level.
Even, like, say if it was even in a, like, a shallow type of dive, would it be able to...
Any airplane can be dive, of course, then you've got the assistance of gravity, right? But there comes a point where the drag of the air overcomes the aerodynamics of the airplane.
For a final word, the same researcher has called Boeing Corporation.
Listen to this.
It has to do with the maximum speed of a 767-200 at 700 feet altitude.
For 200?
Yeah, 767-200, yeah. Like, I had asked some people, and they assumed it would be about 250 miles an hour or something.
That sounds pretty likely, because at 35,000 feet, it's 530 miles.
So there's no way that it could be going 500 miles an hour at 700 feet altitude, then.
Not a chance.
She laughed. Not a chance, question. She said.
Can
not a
you
chance.
Produce any evidence that a Boeing 767 equipped with regular engines can fly for almost 2 minutes beyond 500 miles per hour in the lower strata of the atmosphere without suffering any visible structural damage? Can you explain how amateur pilots who had never flown a jet before in their life could maintain full control of an airliner that has exceeded the VMO by almost 200 miles per hour? And why would some terrorists who have been lucky enough to get within reach of their target want to risk the entire operation by imposing such a stress on the airplane that it would almost certainly cause them to crash before they complete their mission?
Some great questions there, my friends. Some great questions. Why? Impossible. Absolutely, unequivocally impossible. Just ludicrous. Ludicrous. But how can we know? We how could we know these things, right? We couldn't. So where to go next? The fucking Pentagon. Let's see. I feel like so much I want to tell you guys about. So, you know, do we need to go over the towers? You guys know that was physically impossible as well, right? Do you understand that 110-story building, even if you were to believe their nonsense story about somehow office fires weakening steel, that could never, literally never cause a free fall collapse in a building, like... Not on Earth, okay? Not as long as the laws of physics are in motion. Do you understand? It's fucking ludicrous. It's insane. The fact that so many people still believe it is a testament to propaganda and its effectiveness. Not, you know, physics. You have to make magic physics to make these events work with people. Like the magic bullet, the one that did a little dance before it went into Kennedy and went back into Connolly and then back into Kennedy. Same thing with these, with this nonsense that, I mean, this is physics 101, but you have engineers, intelligent people who are like, oh, well, I guess I didn't know enough about it. No, you did know about it. Now you're being taught nonsense. God, most skyscrapers are built on steel or concrete frames, okay? The World Trade Center was built different, man. That thing was an engineering feat. It was built in a tube structure. It was a very strong mesh of steel surrounded the exterior, okay? Inside the core was a rectangle of 47 extremely thick steel columns. That created the base, and that thinned as the building went up in height. These things were marvels of engineering and architecture. Okay, the towers were anchored in at the core, and they were flexible, like a steel net, and they were meant to be flexible. They were built to withstand high winds and any kind of impact from an aircraft, okay? They would bend, they would never break, and they certainly wouldn't collapse into dust, okay? Not ever. I am of the firm belief that you could have crashed 20 planes into those towers and they wouldn't have collapsed. They wouldn't have collapsed. They were not built. Even if you were to collapse, hit 20 in the same spot, you could get maybe just that portion to collapse or slide off. You could never cause a free fall collapse into its own footprint. And then we won't even talk about where the steel went and how we ended up with molten pools of lava. We may have to, but just understand that this is not physically possible. Okay? Be very clear on that, because what I'm going to show you that I believe happened, and that now more than ever, I believe that there was more than one weapon being deployed on that day, and it was not just nanothermite. It was also directed energy weapons. And I'm going to show you a ton of proof of that, but we're going to start next episode with that. I want to show you this real quick. It's very short. Hold on one second.
The only way that a building can accelerate as it collapses is by having pre-engineered, precisely timed, and precisely placed explosives. In other words, controlled demolition.
The collapse of the building was caused by controlled demolition.
In fact, the evidence shows very strongly that there were explosives used in the way the buildings came down.
We started one, floor by floor, instead of popping out.
It was like, it was if it had detonated.
Yeah, detonated.
They were planned to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
All the way down.
Explosives are used to demolish buildings like this in just seconds.
So we're looking at
building 7. Okay, so it's a controlled demolition. What's the problem with that?
And then an acknowledged controlled demolition, side by side.
Controlled demolitions cannot be engineered and rigged in a day. It takes months. And therefore, this event must have been planned in advance.
You think? You think? Okay, one more thing. Hold on. Oh, where is it? 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 Maybe I don't have it. Oh yeah, so also I promised you it was impossible. I'm going to show you why it was impossible, absolutely unequivocally, because the laws of physics, they demand a reckoning. Okay.
NIST received $20 million of taxpayers' money to determine why and how World Trade Center 1 and World Trade Center 2 collapsed following the initial impacts of the aircraft, and to this day, they have not done so.
Fucking taxpayer money.
This is why Architects and Engineers has kept pressing NIST, asking them to publish their data in regards to the potential energy released during the downwards movement of the upper stories and the absorptive capacity of the intact structure below the collapsed zone.
Structural engineers do this every day. This is not rocket science. You have the known weight of this building mass. You have what are known columns below it in order to resist it. You let it go in your models, and you calculate what the resistance is. Why didn't they do it? Could it be because they knew darn well that it would not have collapsed at all?
In fact, it could be suggested that NIST never explained the collapses by gravity alone because it would be impossible to do so without violating at least two of the most fundamental laws of physics. One is Newton's third law of motion, which states that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Oh. This means that two opposing forces will neutralize each other. In a head-on collision, the two cars absorb each other's kinetic energy and transform it into physical deformation or damage. After that, the system comes to a rest, as there is no more energy to be dissipated.
The top section, pushing on the bottom section, it's going to meet equal forces as it goes. Both sections are going to be demolished at the same rate. So by the time you've crushed up 15 stories below it, the top 15 stories are also going to be crushed. And so there's nothing left now to crush the rest of the building.
Something of this kind is what we should have seen when the top section of the towers collapsed onto the lower one.
The
upper and lower sections should have mutually destroyed each other until all the energy is dissipated and the system comes to a rest. Alternatively, as shown in this experiment with two towers made of snow, the top section could have fallen off to the side after the initial collapse.
Yeah, you just see in this example, the top section falls off the side.
A little tiny chunk of the building.
Now we're looking at
can't possibly
what happened,
fall and crush
which is the
entire
towers collapsed straight
this
down.
This is such a simple fundamental concept that architects and engineers were astonished in seeing it totally ignored by NIST.
This is high school physics, and our whole society is being led to believe that these fundamental laws of physics, don't apply anymore.
But even if we assume that the top section of the tower had enough potential energy to destroy the rest of the structure below, it could not have done so at the speed it did, which was near freefall speed. That would have violated an even more important principle in physics, known as the law of momentum conservation. This law states that the total energy within an isolated system must always remain the same. As we have seen, the energy can be transformed within the system, from motion to physical deformation. But for the deformation to begin, the velocity must decrease in order for one kind of energy to be transformed into the other.
Did we see the velocity decrease?
No new energy can be added to the system.
No, we saw the velocity.
One particular example of momentum conservation is free fall.
Okay.
Free fall happens. It's an obstacle and breakage occurs. This have enough energy to do both. Let's go now to the Twin Towers and ask a simple question. Assuming that the top section on the left contains enough potential energy to destroy the rest of the tower, and assuming we dropped both upper sections at the same time, which one would hit the ground first? It would be the second, of course. As it finds no obstacles in its path, the section on the right would quickly accelerate to free fall speed and maintain it all the way to the ground. The section on the left, instead, needs to use some of its energy to destroy the structure below, so it could never achieve
free fall speed. That's below it.
In the case of the Twin Towers, however, both upper sections fell with an acceleration close to free fall speed, as if their path had been practically free from obstacles. It took each tower between 10 and 12 seconds to collapse to the ground, while an absolute free fall time would have been 9.2 seconds.
9.2 seconds.
In other words, both upper sections of the towers found enough energy to destroy 80,000 tons of healthy structure below while accelerating to near free fall speed.
Impossible.
This is, as we have said, absolutely impossible by gravity alone. The law of momentum conservation won't allow it.
A building cannot do free fall with a huge structural system in place to support it.
The Twin Towers could not have come straight
down
through resistance.
These are all engineers speaking now.
Actually hit and made an impact. It was effectively
As energy is...
Only one way for those buildings to have collapsed at the speed they did.
The buildings fall at a speed which can only occur if the structure has been removed, the vertical structure.
Meaning everything below it had to have been taken out. We're going to get into how that may have been possible with the, because even controlled demolition, I mean, this is just, it's crazy to imagine that they tried to convince people that this is what happened. All right, I've stopped sharing. So those are the towers. The towers more people are knowledgeable about that than they are some of the other buildings, you know, like the fact that the 9/11 Commission left Building 7 out of their report, you know, that other building that collapsed 8 hours later, the one that wasn't hit by a plane that we were told collapsed due to office fires, a 47-story skyscraper built like a linebacker. Yeah, right. Ludicrous, man. Ludicrous. Okay, so, you know, they had the progressive collapse, the pancake theory. It's all bullshit, guys. That all that stuff defies the laws of physics. Okay, and then there's physics about steel. All right, just a recap. Steel melts at 2,700 degrees, 2,750 Fahrenheit. Okay, and above. These temperatures are only attained in a blast furnace, okay, or when a powerful incendiary such as thermite is used. Steel or any substance that is burned will never become hotter than the temperature of the fire or the heat that is applied to it. For example, an open air hydrocarbon fire reaches a maximum temperature of 1200 degrees, okay? That's Fahrenheit. And that's in a dirty, uncontrolled burn, you know? That's a typical campfire, guys. And that's characterized by red and reddish-orange flames, all right? Red and orange flames are what we saw on September 11th. Do you recall? If you're watching, I'm sure that we'll have some pictures of those flames for you. Even the fireball caused by the plane strike was red-orange, because, of course, that is kerosene, which is going to go up the moment it's just like any fuel or gas, it's going to go up like that, like a flash. So, you know, math was never my strong suit, guys, but that's 1,000 degrees. Over 1,000 degrees. Too cool to melt steel. Not a few degrees, not a couple hundred. It's a fucking 1,000 degrees too cold. Okay, now, FEMA has officially reported that the jet fuel from the planes would have burned off in the immediate explosion. Okay, so even they admit that, well, you know, we didn't have like an oven effect or a pot that was like boiling. It doesn't work like that. Fuel doesn't ignite like that. Fuel doesn't pool, it just ignites. This myth that the jet fuel was running down the towers and like somebody doused them in gasoline, it's fucking ludicrous. The jet fuel was torched the second the planes hit, all of it. There was no jet fuel running down the towers and the, I mean, this is what our minds do to try to rationalize what we're being told happened, and so that we create images and we try to bridge the gap of reality that has been, you know, made a mockery of. That's what I always used to. That's what I did when I thought about it. I was like, oh, well, the fuel must have run down. And, you know, I mean, you don't think about these things because you're being told one thing, but this is, you know, it's a myth. It's nonsense. It's impossible. So we have massive reports of basement level explosions happening even before the towers hit. I have footage, and I was going to show you this, but I'm trying to pick and choose what to show you guys. I can tell you where to go for it. Every source that I found is going to be listed in my video description. But if you want to hear people talking about how the bombs started going off, the detonation started even before the planes hit, even in Building 7, I have lots of testimony, and you can look at the same testimony, okay? There's 118 documented testimonies of explosions from first responders alone, all of which it took a court order to be released. Now, why would they want to hide those? I mean, that alone should make you suspicious. Why do they want to hide the testimony? Why would you need a court order to release testimony such as this? Who put that under lock and key? Hello? Right? Many reports. I've watched dozens of eyewitness testimony of New Yorkers with dust and blood all over them, reporting that there was bombs going off on the subway in the basement before the second plane hit, before the first plane hit. What inexplicable testimony, unless the whole thing was rigged. And then there's Building 7. You know, that building that didn't get hit by a plane, that building that there is no good excuse for, that came crumbling down at free fall speeds 8 hours after the towers collapsed in record time. Okay. There was pools and pools and pools of basically molten hot lava found for months leading after 9/11, for months in the World Trade Center, in the pools of the ashes where they were. Those temperatures, first of all, it was raining, it was snowing. Nothing put or cooled those temperatures. We have satellite images, okay? You can see all of this. Watch Anatomy of a Great Deception. It's on YouTube. It's on my, go to my playlists on my channel. Go to my Faust Highly Recommends and go to Anatomy of a Great Deception. And you can look at all the testimony and all the lava and all the satellite imagery of these lava pools remaining in place 3 months after. They did not go out until Christmas. Do you know how hot you have to get something in order to burn it like that and then keep it that hot? You need an incendiary device that is not affected by water, by temperature, or by anything else. And nanothermite of the highest grade is the only thing that I think comes to mind for me and for a lot of other people who've looked into this. It can create its own oxygen supply. It's great for you being used underwater. It doesn't matter what's going on in its atmosphere. It's an incredible little catalyst. The fires at Ground Zero burned for 3 months, even after the area was flooded. Okay? When you look at this fact alone, there is no physical explanation for it, my friends. Not even with everything we were told that happened. Okay? It's the only logical explanation. The fires were put out finally on December 13th, 3 months after 9/11. It's the longest burning building fire recorded in the history of mankind. 92-day fire. 92 days. No natural fire will burn for 92 days. Okay? In case you were wondering. God, I so much video to show you guys. But so in part two, I'm going to show you how not only was it nanothermite, but there had to have been other weapons being used. I'm going to show you some serious shit in part two, okay? Because it could not have been a controlled demolition. If it was a controlled demolition, there would have been the seismic activity to match it. And it just so happens that we were recording seismic activity during the attacks. And there was a controlled demolition. We have thousands and thousands and thousands of controlled demolition recordings because we always record the seismic activity, particularly in cities. And so we have massive references and databases. We know what 100-story building would cause on a seismic scale, and it didn't. And why? How? Something we had never seen before, I believe, okay? They have directed energy weapons, and some of them use cold lasers. And I believe, and I'm going to show you some things that you're going to think that you're looking at Maui. You're going to think that you're looking at Chile, California, Australia, or Texas, or any of the recent fires. And I'm going to show you how you're actually looking at 4 blocks from the World Trade Center on 9/11. Inexplicably melted fucking cars, my friends, with that signature microwaved look. And when I saw that, my jaw was on the ground. I could not fucking, I thought I was looking at Maui. And I was looking at pictures of melted buses, melted cars, 4 blocks from Ground Zero. Apparently they have not perfected or had not perfected these weapons then, and maybe missed a little bit. The fuck? I mean, you're not going to believe it. I'm saving that for part two. All right. I want to finish off part one. Okay. We've talked about steel. We've talked about building seven. There's a couple other things that you need to understand. Okay. One thing real quick I want to show you, just so you guys know, when I say that there's no way that these buildings could have withstood any impact, I mean, from 20 different airliners, that's how well built they were. I want to show you guys a video real quick to back up that claim, that I've been making that claim long before I saw this little bit of testimony, and it just validates my hypothesis and my theory. So I'm going to share it because it's worth sharing. Let's see. And then we're going to talk about the Pentagon, the Pennsylvania flight, and finally the fucking cell phone calls. So don't go anywhere, my friends. If you are not subscribed to my channel, please subscribe. If you're listening to this on iTunes, write us a review and give us 5 stars. Spotify, please leave comments. Please share the video. We're trying to grow this channel as big as it should be. I think people have a right to know what has been hidden from them, because with knowledge comes power. And in order to understand the events that are taking place today, you need to understand what has gone on in our past. And America has been lied to like so many countries. We have been propagandized out of the truth by a corrupt and wayward government. So please, if you're not subscribed, please subscribe to my channel. Download my stuff on audio if you can't watch it. And to everyone listening, thank you. I appreciate you.
Example.
This is James Glanz for the New York Times. When the plane hit the North Tower between the 94th and the 98th floors, Steve McIntyre, an engineer for the American Bureau of Shipping, was reading his email on the 91st floor. The plane hit, and I think he described it as the biggest wham he'd ever heard, but there wasn't much shaking. His email was still there after the impact. He was still staring at a glowing screen. He had a little knick-knack. A piece of slate in the shape of a sailboat hadn't fallen off his desk. Pictures of his wife and kids just propped up on a bookcase were still upright. Nothing had fallen over.
McIntyre was just below the point of impact. If his pictures didn't even fall, why should the spray-on fireproofing have been detached from the steel trusses?
That was one of the fucking bullshit reasons they said there was the collapse, but the trusses were destroyed by the impact. Oh, I mean, they had to come up with all kinds of ridiculous things. Okay, so there's that. So now, quickly, let's pivot. Let's get into Flight 93. Okay, this is crazy. Flight 93. So obviously, Flight 93 and the Pentagon flight had a few things in common, okay? Namely, there were no fucking plane parts to be found. How convenient. And the plane parts that were found after the fact and not on the site. So talking about particularly, Flight 93, that plane was carrying 10,000 gallons of fuel at the time of the impact, but there was no plume of smoke that rose from it, from the ground when it exploded. And then there's the fact that there were no plane parts. Even I remember, I think I was freaking 20, 21 years old. I was hungover as shit. And I remember seeing that crash and them saying that this was a plane crash, and I was like, what are they talking about? All there is scorched earth. There's no plane. Even I noticed that, and I was a disaster that morning. But they did find debris then, 8 miles away in a lake. How fucking convenient. That was Flight 93, okay? I mean, the debris field, fucking... Let me just show you this real quick, all right? Real quick. The debris field. And then I want to show you guys the cell phone calls and the Pentagon.
The extension of the debris field is not the only fact suggesting a shoot down. There are other elements that seem to confirm it.
Standing there watching on TV and the lights flickered in the building. About that time we heard the engines roar. And we took off out of the building as we were coming out from the office out through the building. The ground shook and we heard, big boom. Looked over and saw the big ball of fire.
Flegel later told other people about the lights flickering.
I was in Atlanta, and I was sitting there talking to another guy, and I was explaining to him about whenever we were standing in the office and the lights flickered and everything. And as soon as he heard me say that, he immediately stopped me and he said, "Well, I'm retired from the Air Force." He said, "That plane was shot down." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because whenever the lights flickered, they zapped the radar frequency on everything before they shoot."
The mayor of Indian Lake also remembers the power going off just before the crash.
Our power had gone off, and then we felt a tremor. It sounded like a missile came across our house. I mean, they were going that fast.
The mayor of Shanksville, Ernie Stuhl, had something interesting to say. "I know of two people, I will not mention names, that heard a missile," Stuhl said. "They both live very close, within a couple of hundred yards. This one fellow served in Vietnam, and he says he's heard them, and he heard one that day."
Oh.
But who could have possibly shot the plane down? As far as we know, there are no witnesses who saw fighter jets near. Remember seeing the white plane before the crash, not after.
About 11:30 that night, the FBI came, wanted to talk to me. They kept asking me how big the plane was. I said the plane, it was small, wasn't much bigger than my van that I saw, and that it went over top of me. And I said, "You want to make sure maybe it was ours and not somebody else's." And then that's when he did seem to get a little nicer. Told me that it was a white Learjet. Someone was taking pictures. I said, "Before the crash?" And he says, "Well, we got to go."
John Flegel also saw the mysterious plane. Since Flegel arrived on the spot within a minute from the crash, the corporate jet sent by the air traffic controllers would not have had time to descend over the area yet, while the mystery plane was already getting away from the spot into the blue sky.
We got there, like I said, probably within 45 seconds or a minute of impact. We were there. We were there before any firemen, any paramedics, or anybody. We were on site. When we got there, there was a plane flying up above. And he was smart. He flew straight for the sun, so you couldn't look at it and see exactly what type of plane or if it was a fighter or what it was. But we caught a glimpse of it, and as he was swinging,
suspicious.
He was basically traveling in the same direction as the plane.
If the plane was actually shot down, one big question arises.
Okay,
what are we to make of the heroic gesture?
Okay, wait a minute here. So. God, there's so many things I want to show you guys. I'm gonna have to include a lot of it in part two because it's just this. There's just so much. The last thing I want to share with you guys, okay? Let me see here. That was Flight 93. Both planes lacked debris. The Pentagon. Okay, let me just. I'm just gonna go over the Pentagon, and the rest I'm gonna include in our next episode, okay? This madness about the Pentagon. Okay. It's fucking laughable, guys. Okay. This is what they're saying happened. Okay. First of all, the Pentagon has hundreds and hundreds of cameras. Conveniently, none of them worked or picked up any kind of plane or anything happening that day. Just, I mean, that alone speaks volumes. Okay. But then they released that footage which is shown to be tampered with and all this nonsense, okay? And but you have some things that are not dependent on, like, where did the virtual indestructible Rolls-Royce engines of the so-called jetliner that hit the Pentagon go? Where did they go? There is no accounting for them. They couldn't have been evaporated they had to have gone somewhere. They crashed into the ground. Where are they? There is none. There was none. There was none to be found. You have a few debunkers point to this melted slag of fucking nothing and say, "Oh, that was them. That wasn't them. That's not what they look like. They're not easily melted. These things are built to withstand extremely high temperatures." So you have no explanation for the missing engines, period. That's impossible. It's impossible. There's no reason on the planet why these engines would have evaporated, okay? Unless they're lying about what kind of thing hit the Pentagon. And finally, what the so-called airliner did in order to hit the side of the Pentagon is fucking laughable. It's impossible and it's laughable, all right? So this is what they're telling you that this guy, this so-called terrorist, chose to do. Now, when I show you the flight path, you're going to be like, what? I mean, it's insane. I want to finish with this because you'll get a laugh at this ridiculousness, okay? How fucking convenient. By the way, that side of the Pentagon that he hit, it happened to be still reinforced and an experimental wing, bomb-proofed. Nobody was working in it. Perfect for an airplane strike. Let's check this out real quick. Check this out.
Nobody knew that was American 77.
What did you think? It was a military flight of some kind?
I thought it was a military flight.
It was really moving fast.
It was moving very fast, like a military aircraft might move at a low altitude.
Air traffic controller Danielle O'Brien stated, "The speed, the maneuverability, the way that he turned, we all thought in the radar room, all of us experienced air traffic controllers, that was a military plane. You don't fly a 757 in that manner. It's unsafe." Several military and civil pilots have expressed their skepticism about the maneuver. Commander Ralph Kolstad is a former fighter pilot, air flight instructor, and a retired commercial pilot with 27 years of experience. At the Pentagon, he stated, "The pilot of the Boeing 757 did quite a feat of flying. I have 6,000 hours of flying in Boeing 757s and 767s, and could not have flown in the way the flight path was described." Commander Ted Muga, former civil and military pilot, "I just can't imagine an amateur even being able to come close to performing a maneuver of that nature." Captain Russ Wittenberg, a former fighter pilot and an airline pilot for 35 years, "For a guy to just jump into the cockpit and fly like an ace is impossible. There is not one chance in 1,000. To expect the alleged airplane to run these maneuvers with a total amateur at the controls is simply ludicrous."
To be able to fly that curving, descending, high airspeed trajectory into a very low building, you have to be Chuck Yeager to fly that trajectory.
Not only was Hani Hanjour no Chuck Yeager, but apparently he was a terrible pilot with small planes as well. How could an amateur who was deemed unable to fly solo in a Cessna 150, had a poor understanding of the basic principles of aviation, and had never sat once in the cockpit of a 757, suddenly become able to control such a large airliner flying at top speeds? And even assuming he was able to reach Washington with the autopilot, why would he want to disconnect it and hand-fly the plane for another 8 long minutes, performing a totally unnecessary descending maneuver that A. would have drastically increased his chances of an unwanted crash, B. would have increased the danger of being intercepted, C. would have made him lose sight of the target again, D. would have forced him to a much more difficult approach near the ground, E. would have shrunk the target to a tiny strip of cement, F. would have limited the possible damage to the external rings only, when he could have maximized the damage and ensured the most spectacular outcome of the mission by plunging the plane onto the Pentagon's roofs from above.
Why? Why?
It should be noted.
Why? I mean, just try and digest all that. Okay? You have a whole big target. The aerial gymnastics that this so-called pilot would have had to take to fly and come down and stay low for so long. I mean, it is literally impossible. Absolutely, unequivocally. Do you understand? You know what I'm saying? Like he would have had to not only go out of his way to hit the side that he did. It makes no sense whatsoever. It is preposterous. Very convenient if you're the Pentagon and the people planning it, though, to minimize damage. Hit the part of the Pentagon which has been reinforced with Kevlar and steel. God. So, my friends, there's a lot more. There's a whole lot more. In part two, I'm going to get into what I believe are the only people... and institutions and agencies that could have been technically, logistically, and authoritatively responsible for orchestrating the events, the people who had the most to gain, what has happened since with the Patriot Act and the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, of course, and how many lies we've been fed about what we are doing there, why we went there, and just so you can see the entire cookie crumble. You know, that's what I'm trying to do. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation. I didn't get into everything I wanted to, but thankfully I have part two to cover anything I missed. If you enjoyed this video, please leave a comment and let me know. I enjoyed doing this kind of work for you guys. It's a pleasure. And stay tuned for part two. Make sure you're subscribed and you hit the alert notification so you know when it comes out. And let me know in the comments if you enjoyed this presentation. I hope I was able to streamline some of the things that I feel are most, you know, important to realize just how impossible everything was that day. God bless you all. Much love to you guys. Stay safe. Be ready for part two. It's coming soon. Much love, guys. Thank you so much.